Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, a couple problems on the 101 in the East Valley. Northbound, the exit ramp at Indian School is blocked. Southbound, the exit ramp at Warner is blocked. Also on the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at 32nd Street. And on the 10 eastbound at 7th Street, an accident in the median. Partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 83. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 60. Sunny skies right now, 76 degrees.
You've probably heard this line before from airport officials. Be sure to arrive 2 hours ahead of your flight. You might want to roll your eyes at that, especially if you're on a domestic flight. But as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, it's worth taking into consideration.
Sky Harbor Airport is supposed to be America's friendliest airport. So when officials started receiving complaints from passengers about long wait times at TSA security checkpoints, they knew it was time to look at all options. Deborah Ostreicher is the assistant aviation director. When asked if all options included using private screeners, she said,
"We have to consider every option available to make these tenable, not just tenable, but acceptable and friendly for our passengers."
Ostreicher said the reason for the long waits could be a TSA staff shortage, those employees are not being properly allocated, or a combination of the two. She said at times, passengers are waiting 45 minutes or longer, hence the two-hour warning. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Budget watch is back on at the state capitol today. Some lawmakers are likely bleary-eyed, though, as the House Appropriations Committee didn't finish its work until early this morning. Here with an update is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. And Howie, how big right now is the divide between proposals in the House and the Senate?
Well, at this point, we think everyone is starting to sing from the same songbook. There was a belief by a number of Republicans that you're going to have to add back in K-12 money. The agreement that seems to be reached in concept, because remember, we haven't seen the amendment, is to hold schools harmless. The budget that was sent down from the governor and the legislative leadership actually would have cut $21 million, which is not exactly the message you want to send when you're asking voters to go to the polls and approve a $3.5 billion spending plan by taking it out of a trust fund. So I think we're there on that. There are a lot of little details that are still being worked out, some funding that they want to have for everything from podiatrists for folks on the healthcare system to doctors for experts and things like that. So you've got a whole bunch of little things that'll end up complicating floor debate, but we seem to be close on all sides at this point, at least among Republicans. Now, Democrats are another picture entirely.
What about this idea of essentially getting rid of the Board of Regents and giving each of the three universities its own separate board?
This is a proposal by Mark Fincham. It was discussed a little bit last night by the Appropriations Committee and did not get offered. His contention starts with the premise that, A, you've got a board that's spending $2 million a year to do what? And he believes that each university should have its own board with members appointed by the governor. In some cases, it's hard to tell exactly what he wants. I'm anticipating a potential floor fight on that this afternoon, but again, that remains to be seen.
Howie, one non-budget related item that got decided yesterday, it seems like there's been a stand down as far as the solar fight.
Well, the 1960s Cuban Missile Crisis type politics that tends to occur is that we were in a mutually assured destruction phase where the Solar City had proposed a constitutional amendment that would essentially keep the utilities from imposing new charges. The utilities came back through their friends at the legislature with a proposal that would pretty much say that solar customers could be forced to pay more. And I think that at some point, cooler heads prevailed. Now, everyone has agreed to mediation by some outsider, and the governor's office is going to get involved. Now, is there any guarantee that's going to lead to a compromise? Hard to say. I think there's some belief that it could, at least from Solar City side. I think from the perspective of the utilities, is at least they've gotten the Solar City measure off the ballot for this year, and they can pursue their proposals, which already exist before the Arizona Corporation Commission, to change their rate structure.
Howie, the House Appropriations Committee didn't finish until the wee hours of the morning today. Is there sort of a prevailing thought as to what time you guys might be able to get out of there tonight or tomorrow morning?
Well, I think at this rate, it could be tomorrow morning. I mean, you figure that if, in fact, the House does complete its floor debate, let's say by 5 o'clock today, and then it's got to go to the Senate, and they're going to go through the floor debate, and, you know, engrossing the bills and getting a final read, theoretically could get out by midnight. Let me put it this way. I've packed my pajamas.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks. Drink some coffee.
I will get something to keep me awake through all of this.
Earlier this week, Intel announced it would be cutting 560 jobs in Chandler. That was bad news. But numbers indicate the Valley is actually becoming more reliant on small businesses to drive the economy. Part of that is diversification. The newest edition of the Phoenix Business Journal features a cover story on the state of small business. Data compiled by the Business Journal's parent company ranked the Phoenix market 46th out of the 106 largest markets. And Stephen Totten from the publication is here to talk about that. Stephen, how has the impact of small business in Phoenix changed since the Great Recession?
Pre-recession, a large part of those small businesses were construction, kind of real estate-focused small business, obviously. Because of the recession, that changed quite a bit. So now what we're seeing is a large portion of these small businesses are consumer-focused, retailing, restaurants, that sort of thing.
You also talk to some folks who say that collaboration is really important among small businesses. That might surprise people because we think of it being so competitive. Is that something that you're seeing more of, and is that something that maybe Phoenix picked up from other areas, or is this something that people who are running small businesses here just decided, hey, to survive, we should do this?
Yeah, well, I think you definitely hit the nail on the head with the latter point. Once the recession hit, I think a lot of these businesses coming out of the dust, once it cleared, said, hey, we need to kind of get together and make sure this doesn't happen to us again. And so it would be better to collaborate instead of compete. And so you have the Arizona Small Business Association collaborating with essentially every kind of council and association in the Valley, from the Phoenix Tech Council to the Arizona Commerce Authority, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of the technology businesses are also collaborating as well. There is a group that meets once a month. A lot of the tech heads get together and kind of see what's going on, throw ideas around. And then small businesses as well. There's a apparel company out of Chandler, State 48, and they also did that with collaboration, going to a lot of the farmers markets, a lot of these small retail festivals, and used that, collaborated with other businesses to kind of grow their own industry.
You spoke to a couple of businessmen who started a company called Tuft & Needle. They've said a lot of positive things about the small business environment in the Valley.
Tuft & Needle is a great example in that they actually came from Silicon Valley. They were two the founders, Dehi Park and JT Marino, were actually web designers. And they came out to the Phoenix area to start Tuft & Needle, which is a mattress company. They released this article saying that Phoenix is a better environment than Silicon Valley to start a small business. And one reason for that was the cost of living. The cost of running a business was much more affordable here. And the other thing they mentioned was the attention that Arizona government and other business leaders give to these small businesses. They pay a lot of attention. They're very courteous. They take the time to collaborate with these people. And so Tuft & Needle is kind of touting that, is saying Phoenix does have a lot of potential for these startups and these upcoming businesses, and it's paid off for them.
Were you ultimately surprised at all by what the numbers showed, even as a business reporter?
Well, you know, it was interesting. Obviously, when I've been reporting on small business, I see it in bits and pieces. But to see it all come together, Phoenix has a very, very strong small business environment. And that's not only because of the collaboration and the use of technology, but what people in the Phoenix area and people visiting the Phoenix area are doing. There has been a huge influx of these mom and pop shops, these local first initiatives. Obviously, Local First AZ has been doing a lot to kind of promote that idea, and people are really embracing it. You know, it's part of welcoming that Phoenix identity and really feeling like a Phoenician when you buy from a local business, someone that started from the ground up and, you know, is probably lives a few miles away from you. And so pride is a huge part of that growth, I think.
Stephen Totten of the Phoenix Business Journal. We've been talking about the cover story, The State of Small Business. The National Football League draft continues through tomorrow. As part of the NFL's increased efforts to reach out to international fans, including playing regular season games in London, the Oakland Raiders will be announcing some of their picks from Mexico City. The NBA and Major League Baseball are also making a concerted effort to find new fans and new players overseas. To get an inside perspective, I'm joined by Joseph Reeves. Until this season, he was the Los Angeles Dodgers Director of International Relations. Joe, how vital is it for these North America-based teams to have an international reach?
It's crucial. Baseball was behind the NFL, the NBA and the NFL, actually, in expanding overseas. We were slow. We got talent out of the Dominican quite a way, but we never did start playing big time in Asia until probably a little more than a decade and a half ago. That hurt baseball, but they've made up for it in strides. The World Baseball Classic is phenomenal. And when I was with the Dodgers, we had more hits on our website from Taiwan and Korea than we did from parts of California.
You know, I was thinking of when Yao Ming, the Houston Rockets center, played before he got injured and had to retire. The Houston Rockets were getting so much popularity in China, and I also often wonder about that sort of thing. Is that sustainable? Is that something that you have to keep going back to that well and making sure that, those fans are interested, those fans are happy? Or once you establish sort of the ground there, do you feel pretty secure that the fans will be loyal, especially if you're one of the first to go in?
I think the latter. I think once you establish the groundwork, you're in. You see, in China now, the NBA is just, Yao Ming's long gone, but the NBA is the most popular sport aside from football, soccer. So once you're established, you've got it made.
Now, do the sports have to adjust to the market, or and is there an arrogance to sort of say, well, Major League Baseball, National Basketball Association, of course they're going to love us, or do they have to sort of tailor it to an individual country?
I think that's the lesson learned by both the NBA and Major League Baseball, that you do have to tailor it. There was an arrogance. Certainly I saw it from Major League Baseball when they first went in big time into Japan. Major League Baseball still has that arrogance that we do things right and that's it. We don't have to adjust. But they learned in Tokyo. They opened up cafes that were designed for the local fans, and it made a big difference once you start grooming the local market.
When you hear a commissioner in a sport say, you know, maybe we'll consider expanding to one of these other markets, do you take that really seriously? And is that something that would take a tremendous amount of work in many ways? Because once you, this is more than just making a week-long visit. This is actually establishing, in the case of baseball, over the course of 162 games.
Yes, I think it's going to happen, Steve. I think the NFL will lead the way. I think they'll have a franchise in London long before baseball ever gets that way. But I can easily see baseball having a division where you would go over to, say, Japan and play for three straight weeks and come home. And Japanese franchise would come to the States and play for three straight weeks and go home.
Do you think in general that markets see that as, hey, this is a positive step, I'm glad that they're doing this? Or is there the danger of them seeing it as pandering?
I don't think so. I think people want to embrace professional sports universally. I think the fact that the NFL goes into Mexico City is something I think the Mexican community is incredibly proud of. And you see it in reverse. You know, the Premier League and European football, soccer, you know, it's not universally embraced here in the United States, but it has a huge following. And I think you just flip that mirror image onto major sports in U.S. sports in international countries, and you get that feeling. It still is a boutique sport in football and basketball, but the following is growing every year.
Joseph Reeves, former Director of International Relations for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Just like communities in the Valley, Las Vegas is focused on the future of its water supply. And over the past 2 years, that has manifested itself in what the city is considering an economic development tool, water innovation. Earlier this month in Politico, writer T.R. Goldman put together a story titled Las Vegas is betting it can become the Silicon Valley of water. And T.R. Goldman is with me to talk about it. T.R., what is WaterStart? It's a big part of your piece.
WaterStart is really nothing more than a public-private enterprise. It came about because of the nasty hit that Nevada took in the recession. And they suddenly realized, we've got to diversify our economy. I mean, this is a real wake-up call. And so they passed a bill in the state legislature in 2011, and they finally got funding for it, I think, in 2013. And it completely revamped the economic development aspect of Nevada. One of the things they did in addition to this, as part of this restructuring, was to start these little innovative centers. And WaterStart is one of those. And WaterStart's function is to gather technology that involves water, all aspects of water, conservation, water treatment, to take their major clients and ask them what kind of technology they needed to decrease their water usage.
As the leaders in Las Vegas Water go around and speak with potential innovators, what are they offering in return?
They promise them that they will have their clients use them, try them out. WaterStart will vet them because WaterStart has a very tight relationship with the Desert Research Institute and with the University of Nevada. And WaterStart will vet these projects if they sort of pass muster, if they make sense, if they seem that they could conceivably be commercially viable. They'll call up the Southern Nevada Water Authority and say, hey, you were looking for something to clean your ion tubes with, right? Well, we got this guy over here. Why don't you talk to him and maybe you can try his technology out? They try it out. WaterStart will help pay for the initial test pilot. And if they try it out and Southern Nevada Water Authority likes it and buys it, then that guy's golden. Whoever sold it to them just goes around to the water industry and say, hey, these things I make, Southern Nevada Water Authority's using them. That's all you need to know. Because, as I figured out or found out doing this story, the water industry is incredibly conservative. It's conservative and it's fragmented. It's conservative because it involves health. And if somebody makes a mistake because they're trying out some new technology and people get sick or die, then they're sort of, that's just unacceptable. Mm-hmm. It can't happen. Mm-hmm. And the other problem is it's very fragmented. There are 55,000 community water systems in the country, but 1% serve populations over 100,000. So you have big systems, but only a few big systems. And it's really the big systems that you're going to sort of get people to try out stuff on. And so WaterStart works as a lever.
And they're hoping this can be an economic development tool.
It's a pipeline for job creation that starts small and gets bigger. And ultimately what they're hoping is to create this virtuous circle where you have X number of people that have their water technology being produced in Las Vegas, say, and that creates a specialized workforce. That attracts more companies, which brings in more of a specialized workforce, and it starts to snowball. That's ultimately the goal, what they're trying to do.
Writer T.R. Goldman, he wrote a recent piece for Politico called Las Vegas is Betting It Can Become the Silicon Valley of Water. For more on what Las Vegas is doing on water innovation, I turn to University of Arizona law professor Robert Glennon, who wrote extensively about water in Sin City in his book Unquenched. Robert, what do you think of this premise?
I think the idea is that once you get a certain mass, you've got some synergies going on, and you get people going back and forth, and you get kind of incubators. And if you can tie that into some grants to encourage the companies to locate in your community, then there's a chance that that will happen. And I think there are hubs, around the country that you see that happening in. Whether you can do it in water, I don't know. The problem with startups, and especially those that are in the tech world, is that they're not obligated to be any place in particular. They can pretty much do their stuff anywhere. One of the big challenges for the water space is to try to find companies who can develop a business plan that will actually allow them to make money. At the end of the day, if they don't make any money, it's not going to work.
You've written in the past about the importance of water pricing. How significant is that in what we're talking about?
As I travel around speaking to groups, I meet inventors and engineers who have built things that actually work, that actually save water. But almost a person, none of these people has a viable business plan because the price of water is just too darn low. So in one kind of perverse way, it's not that we need more water innovation or more new technologies. The existing technologies that we could simply take off the shelf and apply aren't being utilized because there's not a big enough incentive to save water.
Are we in a situation where it's going to take people feeling like we're on the cusp of a disaster for them to actually not only to have communities willing to raise the price of water, but people willing to pay it?
Well, a disaster always helps, and I mean that only partly tongue-in-cheek. Mm-hmm. It focuses attention, and you saw that last year in California. But as quickly as there was a reasonable snowpack this year, you're starting to see some communities in California say, well, drought's over. We want to go back doing what we were doing before. We need to pay more not just to encourage people to conserve, although that's important. We also need to pay more because our water and wastewater systems across the country are in a terrible state of disrepair. And we currently see water leaking in excess of a trillion gallons a year across the country from existing pipes. If you think about that, that's really, it's a horrible affair because this is water that's been treated to drinking water quality, and then it never gets to people's homes and businesses because the pipes are leaking.
Well, so where does this innovation then that Las Vegas is talking about, where does something like that come in? Because that seems like something that would have practical use and that people might actually want to invest in, therefore going back to the idea of actually making money with some of this innovation.
Oh, I think it is. And it, as communities start to spend more and more money on leak detection and overhauling the pipes, there are some neat companies out there that give you meters and devices so that you can tell which pipes are leaking. You can tell which pipes need to be replaced. It will cost money. So at some point, some people will make money, whether it's the Silicon Valley startup group in Las Vegas, that remains to be seen. But they will have some headwinds because the price of water is so low.
The University of Arizona's Robert Glennon, the author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It.
For the past 5 years, Phoenix has been giving out comic books encouraging bike safety to 12 to 7-year-olds. But recently, the comics have generated some controversy because of their graphic nature. The stories typically feature two cyclists, one of whom makes a good choice, the other makes a bad one. The books show the consequences of those decisions, often in pretty gory detail. Kerry Wilcoxon is the traffic engineer with Phoenix's street department and is in charge of the safety and neighborhood traffic section.
The thing that's been probably the most controversial up to this point has been the fact that the boy that chooses the wrong course of action usually ends up with a pretty gruesome injury. And we felt that that would be the kind of thing that would appeal to boys in this age range, and girls too, by the way. But we felt that, you know, if we could compete with something like, I don't know, Mortal Kombat, some of the other violent video games that that are popular, we'd be more likely to grab their fleeting attention.
Well, as you mentioned, the idea that some of these comic books are, shall we say, graphic, has certainly gotten people's attention, and as you say, has generated some controversy. Are you surprised at the level of controversy and the level of, I don't know, discussion that has happened about this?
I'm surprised. I guess I'm surprised that it's kind of come up again. But before these comics were released, we made sure that we vetted them, if you will, against with both educators, parents, even students. We made some edits based on what they had recommended. But really, I think everyone understood at the time, and even now, most people still understand that we're really trying to get a message across that that's important, and it's a tough environment to do that kind of education.
One of the other criticisms that I've read about is this idea that by having the kinds of images that you have in these comic books, you might be frightening kids from actually riding their bikes in the first place with or without a helmet, and that in an age when, you know, kids need to be active, and in an age when there's concern about kids not being active enough, you're discouraging those who are trying to do something athletic and physical from doing that.
Sure. Yeah, we've heard that as well. And, you know, obviously that's not our intent of the program. But the other thing that we've noticed, and this has also been kind of the one of the surprising things about the controversy coming up now. As I said, the books have been out for 5 years. And in every year since the books have been out, or since we've been actively handing them out, we've actually seen an increase in not only the number of school-age bike events, we've seen an increase in the number of kids who go to those events. So we're not seeing any evidence that the books or the messages in the books are discouraging kids. We're actually, if anything, seeing the opposite. Now, we don't believe that because of the graphic comics, people are more likely to bike, but we're certainly seeing an increase in the interest.
Given the infrastructure for bicycling that is in place in Phoenix, I'm wondering how much impact do you think bike safety has in making sure that riders know about what they should and should not be doing, and how much of it falls on sort of the infrastructure that's there and the drivers who are on the road in many ways sharing the road with bicyclists?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that we really struggle with. We're hoping that the comics drive home the concept that, hey, you know what, biking is great. It's a lot of fun. Gives you a lot of freedom as a kid, and it's a great city to bike in. But there are dangers out there, and we're not trying to hide that. But we want to make sure that we provide kids with the tools and the information that they need to make good decisions and to become better bicyclists and ultimately better drivers when they get to that age as well.
Kerry Wilcoxon is the traffic engineer with Phoenix's street department. He's in charge of the safety and neighborhood traffic section. By the way, the city's gotten a grant for this year to develop a bike safety series for kindergarten through third graders. Wilcoxon says those should be ready by the fall and will probably have less gore in them. There is a prescription drug abuse problem in our country that's led to a heroin epidemic. In Arizona, heroin overdoses have more than doubled in the last several years. And in 2007, drug overdose deaths overtook motor vehicle crashes as the leading cause of injury-related deaths in the state. That's still true today.
On average, there's about one death a day from prescription opioid pain relievers. So it's really preventable and unfortunate tragedy that's occurring across Arizona.
Sheila Scholander is the Assistant Director for Public Health Prevention Services at the Arizona Department of Health Services, and she wants to get the word out about this weekend's National Prescription Drug Take-Back, coordinated by the Drug Enforcement Administration. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger spoke with Scholander ahead of the event, and Lauren, tell us a little bit about it.
So the DEA holds two of these prescription drug take-back events a year, and tomorrow there will be collection sites set up all over the state where you can take your unused prescription drugs and dispose of them, no questions asked. At past take-back events in Arizona, they've collected more than 45 tons of unwanted or expired prescription drugs, according to the DEA. And they say this keeps them out of the hands of addicts and safe from being misused or abused.
So are prescription painkillers not safe in your medicine cabinet?
Not necessarily. Scholander with the health department says the best way to keep prescriptions safe is to lock them up. And this is because there's a clear link between the nation's heroin epidemic and prescription drug abuse, especially among young people. So I talked to Adonis Denise Jr. about this. He's the prevention coordinator with Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care.
Heroin use is on the rise, primarily with younger adults, kind of college age into their mid-20s. What we've seen the last few years is a kind of a slow but steady increase in the deaths related to heroin, and a lot of that stems from the increase in prescription drug use among youth.
So he says what's happening is young people are taking prescription painkillers after they have a surgery or at a party, and they're getting addicted. Then when those prescription pills become too expensive or they get too hard to find, they turn to heroin.
It can be expensive and a little bit difficult to access once the addiction kind of takes over. And so heroin is a lot cheaper, and anecdotally, it's easier to access versus getting opioid medication.
And Lauren, addiction can really happen that quickly?
Yes. Denise Jr. says these are very powerful, fast addictive drugs, and their chemical makeup is very similar to heroin. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports people who are addicted to opioid prescription painkillers are 40 times more likely to be addicted to heroin.
So are people just abusing extra drugs that are left around the house?
That seems to be exactly what's happening a lot of the time. Here's Scholander with the Department of Health Services again.
In fact, the data from the Arizona Youth Survey tells us that about 3/4 of youth who misuse prescription drugs are getting them from family and friends or right out of the home, which is why it's so important to safely store prescription drugs and to dispose of them properly.
The Department of Health Services is actually trying to raise awareness about this with specific professions, too, like realtors and funeral directors. They've also done some work in the last few years to guide doctors, emergency departments, and pharmacists about best practices for prescribing opioids.
Well, are doctors prescribing more opioids now than they have in the past?
A lot more. Scholender says this all began around 2000, when the medical community was really urged to address pain in a much more aggressive way.
So lo and behold, here we are a good 15 or so years later, and we've seen a tremendous growth in the sheer number of prescription opioids being dispensed. It's like increased fourfold in that amount of time, as well as the number of drug overdose deaths due to prescription opioids.
That's Sheila Scholender with the Arizona Department of Health Services talking about prescription drug and heroin abuse here in Arizona.
And the Drug Enforcement Administration's National Prescription Drug Takeback is tomorrow, Saturday, April 30th, at locations all across the valley.
And we'll link to a list of those locations where you can drop off your prescriptions at theshow.kjzz.org.
That's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
This year marks the National Park Service's 100th birthday. Among many celebrations and observances, National Geographic has come out with a new guide to the country's national parks. Ford Cochran is the director of programming for National Geographic Expeditions. And Ford, what's new about this edition?
Well, what we did, I mean, they're always adding new parks, for one thing. Pinnacles is a recent addition in California, so there are now 59 big parks. Those are the parks, the national parks, designated by Congress, you know, legislated, signed off by the president. There are actually more than 400 national parks, if you count all the national seashores and lakeshores, national monuments, national historic sites, and so on, that are managed by the National Park Service. But we wanted to basically make everything new this time. All the text is new. We did new interviews, did new research to learn more things about the parks. We got hundreds of new photographs, made new maps. And so there's just all sorts of material in here that's new and different.
Do you find that people use the national parks in the same way that they have in the past?
You know, it's funny. The people of the U.S., it depends on where you live. I think you are so lucky. Of course, you're in Phoenix. You're surrounded by incredible splendor. It's an easy, you know, day trip or, you know, a weekend drive to some of the most absolutely spectacular parks, not just in the United States, but in the entire world. Now, back east, we have some great parks, too. I live near Washington, D.C. We've got Shenandoah nearby. I've taken my kids down to Great Smoky Mountains in the car and up to Acadia National Park. So there are places we can get to as well. But you've got so many close by. Now, many of my friends from here in the east have never visited the national parks of the west. They dream of going to Europe, of going to exotic places, to Asia, to Australia. But many of them don't even think about visiting these wonders that we have here in the U.S.
We hear so much about how certain parks are not funded properly and have backlogs of maintenance and other kinds of things. Does that hamper visitation, do you think?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, when trails aren't maintained or when roads aren't properly maintained and the park has to close them, or if there's a federal shutdown, a big federal shutdown has happened, you know, a few years ago, and the parks themselves have to be closed as a consequence. I mean, that's a real cost. That's really, you know, unfortunate. I think what it underscores, though, is the fact that the parks, even though they've been set aside, even though they've been dedicated, parks are only as protected as every generation chooses to make them.
I would imagine that as technology has evolved, supporters of the parks and National Geographic have been able to try to use technology to maybe get people who can't physically get to the park to see it or maybe teach people about the parks. I'm curious about where you sort of draw the line between using technology to benefit national parks, but not using it so much that people don't look up from their screens when they're actually in the park to see what's right in front of them.
Sure. Well, it's always an issue, right? That question of sort of being present, you know, in nature when you get into nature. And my colleagues here at the Geographic, we know there's an incredible place for all these tools that we have. Almost every school kid in our country is carrying around a smartphone he or she could use to take photos, make short films about the things they care about. They can use that technology to become powerful advocates for the places they care about, the things they experience and see, including the parks. And so that's a real positive benefit. Of course, what you want to do, though, is make sure that they put those devices away long enough to experience nature. And the good news is, I know I've taken my kids who love their technology, but when I've taken them out to places like the Grand Canyon, right in Arizona, and Bryce and Zion and Yosemite and Death Valley, they're just so impressed that it brings them into the moment. They put their devices away, and we go on hikes, and they just enjoy it.
Based on your travels and based on your work, what would you say right now is the state of American national parks?
Well, I'm sure there are people who are more versed in the degree to which the funding is adequate, the numbers of projects they want to take on, and so on, and whether they have the funding to do it. But I'm grateful to say that there still is, I think, a really deep commitment among the American people to keeping the parks vital, to keeping them alive, and supporting the network.
Ford Cochran is Director of Programming for National Geographic Expedition. Ford, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
First, you see it pop up on a couple of restaurant menus, a food you've never heard of before. Then suddenly, it's everywhere. You can't escape it. Maple bacon donuts come to mind here. Food trends can easily spoil through oversaturation, or sometimes they grow slowly and stick around, like fermentation. The show's Annika Klein digs in.
Stroll through the Uptown Farmers Market in central Phoenix, and you'll find flowers, fruits and veggies, coffee, the usual market goods.
Yeah, totally. So this one is the apple, kale, and cabbage. It's got horseradish root and mint.
But step up to the Green Goddess Ferments booth, and it feels more like a pharmacy.
All right, so this is 2 ounces twice a day, or if you're getting a little sluggish in the afternoon, have a good 2 ounce shot of this, and it just gives you a little boost of energy.
Owner Suzette Smith is talking about kraut juice with a customer. If you've never heard of kraut juice, then maybe the fermentation bug hasn't bitten you just yet. Smith says she fell into it through her work in health and nutrition.
And I came across, this fermentation and started playing with it, sharing it with friends, and that old adage of, you should take this to the market kind of happened, and here we are, a year later, still selling sauerkraut.
Interest in this ancient process is now growing in Phoenix, Smith says. Enough for her to start the city's first fermentation festival.
We will be doing a class on kefir, how to make your own kefir, how to make kombucha.
Kefir and kombucha are the quirkier cousins in the fermentation family, but you probably know some of the other members.
Most people don't realize they're probably very large fans of fermentation because it is a crucial role in creating so many foods that we all love. Everything from coffee to chocolate to bread to pickles all require fermentation to exist.
That's Lauren Saria. She's the food editor for the Phoenix New Times, and she has seen trend after trend trickle down to Phoenix after making their way through other cities. And fermentation is no different.
We're a little behind, but we'll get there.
What might preserve this trend, she says, is it actually acts as a junction where many different food trends meet.
People are sort of coming to it from different interests, whether it be making your own bread leads you to an interest in sourdough and therefore fermentation, or home gardening, leads you to wanting to make pickles, and that then leads you to fermentation.
To see that theory in action, hop over 2 states to Texas, where the Austin Fermentation Festival has become the Texas Farmers Market's biggest event of the year. Kate Payne is the organizer, and she says she was shocked the first year when more than 2,000 people attended.
We were like, who are all these folks? Because we don't see all of them at the farmers markets or at food events. It was just this really cool gathering of folks that have an interest in some sort of fermentation projects. And since we cover all of them, it really brought a whole bunch of different people together.
Big festivals like that have been at the center of the fermentation trend, from Santa Barbara to Boston to Portland. And Suzette Smith says that's fitting.
It's about empowering and inspiring people. And if we can empower them to make their own, then we're making our community a better place.
By exchanging live cultures through a culture of community. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
The Phoenix Fermenters Festival is tomorrow from 2 until 6 at the Uptown Farmers Market.
The Grand Canyon is one of the most visited national parks in the country, but in the early part of last century, not so much. That started to change, though, thanks in part to the Santa Fe Railway and its concessionaire, the Fred Harvey Company. A new exhibit at the Heard Museum looks at their role in helping people discover the Grand Canyon, American Indian culture, and the Southwest more broadly. I met Diana Pardue, the Heard's curator of collections, and research associate Kathy Howard at the exhibit. They've also written a book together on this subject. And I asked Howard about the impact of Harvey's Indian Museum and shop that opened at the Alvarado Hotel in Albuquerque.
It was filled with wonderful, wonderful treasures. People could get off the train, they could stay in the hotel, they could have a wonderful meal, and they could buy exquisite things made by Native artists. There were also Native artist demonstrators there from time to time, and so people could actually see pieces of art being constructed by these folks.
What was the level of knowledge and understanding about Indian communities by people who did not live in areas with those communities before they had this exposure to them on the train?
Well, remember the Indian Wars were just getting over at the end of the 1800s. And so people might have been a little bit timid coming out west. But what the Harvey Company did and collaboration with the Santa Fe Railway was to present the area and its people as a safe place and an interesting place to go where you could see other cultures.
Diana, how much of what the Fred Harvey Company did was marketing and trying to make money, and how much of it was a legitimate interest in trying to expose people to a different culture?
Well, it's really interesting because what we've learned is that initially this idea was developed to promote travel on the train, but actually it became a very lucrative business for the Harvey Company, buying and selling Native American art. And they did that to individuals and some very powerful people like William Randolph Hearst, but also they sold large collections to natural history museums and museums that were just developing and museums that were interested in Native American art.
Obviously, back then, the idea of exploitation was not what it is now. And I'm curious, looking back, this in some ways created new markets for some of the American Indian craftspeople to sell their wares to a new market of people. But where do you see sort of the balance of, yes, this might help some people, but in another way, maybe it was kind of exploiting them as well?
Well, I think certainly we can look at the way Native imagery was used, and today we would certainly think of it as appropriation. When Kathy Howard and I began this research more than 20 years ago, because this is the second exhibit that we've done on this topic, we and other colleagues interviewed at that time elders who were in their 70s, 80s, and 90s and talked with them about the Harvey Company and their experiences. What we found was that generation saw that relationship as being very beneficial because it offered a source of income. In talking with a generation younger, we found that that generation really looked at the relationship more analytically and more critically.
Kathy, what was the Fred Harvey Company's picture of the Southwest? What was it trying to project?
Well, it was projected as a beautiful, exotic place with very interesting people that you wouldn't see in Chicago or New York City. It was a collaborative effect between the Santa Fe Railway and the Fred Harvey Company, and they worked hand in hand to promote this. They had artists that created beautiful pieces of ephemera. They are like art, and people were captivated by this. They took these brochures and ticket folders and menus back home, and they were the advertising medium to all the folks that then wanted to come out. It was like a show and tell when they went back home.
Diana, do you think that there's a connection to be drawn between the growth of Arizona and maybe to some extent even the Phoenix area and the Fred Harvey Company in terms of showing people an area that they didn't know about and maybe convincing them to come here and stay here?
You know, I'm not as certain about growth, but definitely we can see a correlation with travel. And the way the Harvey Company depicted the Southwest and offered it at times as alternatives to travel to Europe, if you think about the period during World War I or World War II when people were hesitant to go there, or even alternates at times to travel to Mexico. So it was presented in a very attractive way and an engaging way.
Kathy, what do you take as sort of the lasting legacy of the Fred Harvey Company? Obviously, what they do is not done now. So what do you take as the legacy of this company on the state, on Indian communities, especially in the northern part of the state?
Well, the Fred Harvey Company was just so important to evolving tourism during the last 100 years. You couldn't go to the Grand Canyon without going on a Santa Fe train for a while. You couldn't go there without staying in a Fred Harvey establishment. The Grand Canyon now has about 5 million visitors a year. It's an iconic place, and Fred Harvey and the company developed that interest. They developed that attraction.
Do you think that absent the Fred Harvey Company, that the Grand Canyon would be the tourist attraction that it is now?
It would probably be the tourist attraction it is now, but not nearly as charming.
Kathy Howard is a research associate at the Heard Museum. I also spoke with Diana Pardue, the Heard's curator of collections, about the new exhibit called Over the Edge, Fred Harvey at the Grand Canyon and in the Great Southwest. Well, as usual, busy weekend coming up. Lots of good stuff to do this weekend. But, you know, maybe tonight you just want to sit outside and watch the sunset.
You know, Mark, most nights seems like it's pretty amazing out there.
You know, guys, it doesn't just seem like it. Science says so.
Oh, that's our producer, Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, what do you mean?
Well, you know, in Phoenix, we're pretty spoiled with sunsets. It seems like every night the sky is just blazing with oranges and reds and, of course, the Purple Mountain's majesty.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But it turns out Phoenix really does have the best sunsets in the country. A team based out of Penn State's Weather Communications Group called Sunset Weather, they use meteorological data to map and predict where the best sunsets are going to be, and Phoenix almost always comes out on top. I talked with one of the founders, Ben Reppert, about what metrics they use to figure it out.
This is the first thing of its kind that uses hard meteorology and strictly meteorology to go with the quality of a sunrise or sunset. We incorporate a lot of different layers of the atmosphere. We go from the surface up to about 25 to 30,000 feet. And that's important because all different levels of the atmosphere and clouds and the moisture profiles at those different levels all have big implications. So we take into account relative humidities, we take into account general cloud cover, and then we have a weighting scheme because, for example, high clouds up around 25,000 feet are going to be more of a good thing than, say, low clouds down around 5,000 feet. Hmm. So after a lot of number crunching and trial and error, we came up with a weighting scheme of all of those different levels and those different variables to come up with what we thought was more important than something else and by how much more it was important.
And it seems like you had to probably go about trying to identify what beauty is too, right? Like what constitutes a beautiful or a visually pleasing sunset? How did you go about that?
Right. So that was all along, that was our biggest challenge because of course, everyone's definition of a beautiful sunset, you could ask 10 different people and probably get 8 or 9 different responses. So that's why we took a qualitative approach to this as to more of a quantitative approach. And we came to the general consensus that a sunset with no clouds in the sky, just the sun going down, didn't constitute a really good one. So we went with the idea that the presence of some clouds to be able to reflect the colors of twilight, and so that the viewer can see it, those like the reds, the yellows, the oranges. We came to the conclusion that the presence of clouds, particularly high clouds, is what would be considered more of a vivid sunset. And in the case where it's just the sun going down in a cloudless sky, that's more middle of the road in terms of our scale. And then overcast or thick clouds, thick low clouds, where there's really just no color at all, that's more at the bottom end of our scale, which would show up as the poor colors, the blues, the purples.
So what is it about the Phoenix area that seems to give us so many great sunsets?
I'll tell you what, it has a lot to do with the fact that, first, with the hopes of getting a sunset, you need good odds of at least seeing the sun at some point. Obviously, being in the southwestern part of the United States, sunshine is usually a good bet on more days than it isn't, and given the climate of the area, oftentimes the lower part of the atmosphere is usually drier than it is moist. So any cloud cover in that part of the country, when you tend to get cloud cover, it tends to be of the high variety. It tends to be sometimes what we consider jet stream cirrus clouds, where it's more ice clouds that are associated with the high-level winds, say 20 or 25,000 feet up, and with some moisture that came from the Pacific at some point. And that basically goes along with our scale, that a more vivid sunset is dependent on the presence of some high clouds. So in the Southwest, you take the combination of usually expecting some sun on a normal day, combined with if you have cloud cover, it's likely going to be of the high variety. So it seems to be a good place where you can expect an optimal combination.
So, Jimmy, how accurate are these predictions?
Well, they want feedback, so you can check out tonight's sunset prediction at their website, sunsetwx.com, and then tweet them a picture of what happens in your area. But so far, the predictions have been pretty spot on.
Do you think anyone else besides meteorologists and photographers would use this site?
Well, Ben told me he thinks their data could help everyone, from people giving sunset tours at the national parks to movie crews looking for the right conditions. And they're even thinking about using similar metrics to create a rainbow forecaster.
But Jimmy, isn't the best part of these things just the spontaneity, you know, the wonder of stumbling upon something beautiful and basking in the splendor of nature?
No, Mark. It's always better to know in advance.
Okay. That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jimmy.
You got it, guys.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.